Tonight, you will be an ear witness as a guided missile soars 270 miles high in one of the most unusual recordings ever broadcast. On Hear It Now with Edwin R. Murrow and the voices of President Harry Truman, General James Van Fleet, Senator Charles Toby, the Duke of Windsor, Senator Robert Taft, and more than 40 other men and women in the news in the 24th performance of CBS's Document for Ear, presented tonight and every week at this time.
Think what a responsibility your president faces in a situation of this kind. If you'd think and think clearly on this subject, you'd get behind him.
I just want to say that the Senate Crime Investigating Committee will keep an eagle eye on this game. Be ye clean, even though your trousers be muddied on the playing field.
While a king's story is strictly non-fiction, I only wish that I had thought to add the old familiar ending of all romances, and they lived happily ever after.
Hear It Now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a Document for Ear based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were recorded in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
For 2 weeks, the men in the line in Korea had waited for phase number two in the communist spring offensive. As they waited, they bathed in the Han River, did their laundry, wrote letters, and spent 30 minutes a day with their non-coms brushing up on the nomenclature and use of that weapon which even the atom bomb hasn't outmoded, the bayonet.
Stab! 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 Stab!
A week ago tonight, those bayonets went into action as the enemy counteroffensive got underway. Like the floodgates of a dam, the enemy opened its locks and sent the human sea against our lines. General Van Fleet described it this way.
The attack was initiated by a mammoth assault against UN forces in the East Central Sector. The weight of five Chinese Communist armies, as well as three North Korean corps, was thrown against Republic of Korea units and elements of the 10th Corps.
The entire 8th Army was ready for them. So were the infantry companies of the line. The bayonet training paid off. Beside the men with the bayonets were the long rows of men with carbines and M1s. And beside them, the Tommy guns. Not as accurate, but with much more firepower, cutting down the enemy. And just a few hundred yards to the rear, the water-cooled machine guns, spitting out hundreds of rounds a minute. And although there were no enemy tanks to speak of, our anti-tank weapons, the bazooka and the recoilless rifle, were used to pin down communist clusters before they could leave their hiding places. And behind them, the men with mortars, lobbing in their shells. All day and all night, our heavy tanks prowled the area, waiting for the mines to be lifted.
Tanks, go on up through our position.
Acting as frontline weapons, the Navy sent its Corsairs in, strafing and bombing with fantastic accuracy, the targets which the infantry observation posts pinpointed by radio. Behind all this, the big guns, the 155s, pounded away at enemy positions. At the beginning, even this enormous wall of firepower had to give before the savage onslaught. The 2nd Division split down the middle. A South Korean division almost collapsed. But by Sunday, the Korean unit had regrouped itself, and General Tiny Ruffner's 2nd Division had used its temporary split as a vice, which in a 24-hour period killed more men than make up an American division, almost 15,000. All day and all night, the Air Force sent its bombers overhead, hitting the enemy in his staging areas. And on the east coast of the Korean Peninsula, the battleship New Jersey lay at anchor, and like a floating gun platform, struck the enemy hard at Wonsan. The New Jersey was hit by enemy shore batteries, but is still in combat. On Saturday, the enemy attack began to stall. On Sunday, the Allied line, from carbine to mortar to 155s, stepped up their attack. On Sunday evening, General Almond of the 10th Corps reported that his men had killed or wounded 24,000 Reds in that one day. On Monday, the Reds reached their deepest point of penetration. By evening, the retreat was beginning. Allied patrols went in after them. Our defense became an offense. By Thursday, some divisions had gained as much as 6 miles. Some patrols had again crossed the 38th parallel. Yesterday, General Van Fleet summed it up for us.
The enemy achieved an initial deep penetration in the Republic of Korea sector, which constituted a serious threat to United Nations positions, and reserves were rushed to the threatened areas. But again, as in the February offensive, the gallant 2nd United States Division, with attached equally gallant French and Netherlands battalions, bore the brunt of the assault. This magnificent fighting force, under Major General Ruffner, stopped the enemy cold. The carefully prepared United Nations defensive positions, employing 3 bands of double apron barbed wire entanglements, protected by mines and covered by the heaviest concentration of artillery yet encountered in the Korean War, inflicted crippling casualties to the enemy. Also, prisoner reports have attested to the effectiveness of both 8th Army artillery and the night bombing attacks of the Air Force, which in many cases broke up attacks before the enemy assault units could leave assembly areas. The situation, then, is one to inspire full gratification but not undue optimism. The enemy tactics of precipitous withdrawal, followed by violent counteraction, are too well known. But it is sufficient to say that the enemy has been severely defeated in his so-called second phase of action, and his initial success with deep penetration was turned into a complete failure.
Secretary of Defense Marshall, who is no easy optimist, said this to the boys at the front.
The lights are going up again all over the free world, and they're growing brighter day by day. I say to you, courageous men, you are fighting to great purpose because you have a great purpose to fight for. May God bless you and protect you in the great battle now in progress.
Out in Wichita, Kansas, there was considerable pride in a grocery store on one of the unfashionable streets. The son of grocer John Jabara had, over the weekend, become the world's first jet ace. By tradition, an ace is a pilot who has shot down 5 or more enemy planes. Captain Jabara had become an ace over Germany in the last war. Last Saturday, over North Korea, not far from the border, he knocked down numbers 5 and 6 for this war. 2 Russian MiGs at 20,000 feet in less than 3 minutes. Out at the Jabara grocery in Wichita, his father, an immigrant who came to America in 1911, sat down and wrote his son a telegram. We recorded him reading it.
Today, that I am bursting with pride. I thought I was proud of you when you were 8 years old. When you started working beside me in the grocery store after school. I thought I was proud of you that night when you received your diploma from the North High. I thought my pride had reached its peak during World War II when you downed 6 enemy planes over Germany. But no father in the entire United States could possibly be as proud as I am today. Tears fill my eyes as your old friend and neighbor shower me with the congregation's good wishes, which are really meant for you, my son. The whole world is claiming your bravery. Please let your father pause for a moment in all the excitement to say, good work, Jimmy. May God always be with you.
Another American paid tribute to the men fighting in Korea. Harry S. Truman, who is never so good or unpredictable as when he throws away his prepared speeches and says what's on his mind, stood before a banquet audience in Washington. But his words were for the men listening to the Armed Forces radio in Korea.
When we sit here tonight, in our evening clothes, partaking of food off of white tablecloths, and enjoying ourselves in other ways, bear in mind that there are men fighting and dying in an endeavor to reach that peace for which we've been striving since World War ceased. In order to accomplish that purpose, you must quit your bickering here at home. You must quit playing petty politics. You must remember that there are certain things that have to be done here at home if we're going to accomplish this purpose in the world. We're fighting for time. The young men in Korea and Japan are fighting for time for us. There's always an emphasis on the casualties in Korea. Of course, when there's fighting, there are casualties. But did it ever occur to you that if this necessity with which we are faced is not met, that the casualties in Korea will be one small drop in a bucket? One of those horrible bombs of which we talk so much. Think what a responsibility your president faces in a situation of this kind. If you'd think and think clearly on this subject, you'd get behind him and help him to win this peace, and that's what I'm asking you to do, and that's what our armed services in Korea wants you to do. I hope every one of you will go home, get down on your knees, and pray for guidance to do the right thing, that these young men that are now fighting on the battlefields of Korea shall not die in vain. It's up to you.
Two illustrious senators, both tall trees in the forest of presidential possibilities, spoke this week. Robert Taft of Ohio and Paul Douglas of Illinois spoke at the American Assembly at Arden, New York. And both senators were able to concede that in a Washington atmosphere of disunity, there is a considerable area of agreement. As Senator Taft put it,
I think it may be said today that there is a very wide agreement on this principal purpose of our foreign policy today, and that all of us agree that a policy must be adopted to contain communism where it is today and to prevent its extension. I think it may be said that we agree on the basic strategy of that policy today, and that the differences which have arisen relate rather to the tactics by which that strategy shall be carried out.
Senator Paul Douglas, a Democrat and an old Marine, claimed that Taft was writing off the importance of the infantry division.
The scientist always wants to abolish the infantryman and to transform a war into a push-button affair in which science is dominant. But in every war that has occurred, it's the human spirit that is ultimately tested, and it is the land armies and the infantrymen who ultimately make the difference between success and failure.
The senator from Ohio on future wars.
I do not think that we should undertake to go to war to improve the standard of living of other peoples or to maintain their liberty. It is undoubtedly true. I differed very strongly with Mr. Roosevelt in his idea that we should go to war to protect the four freedoms throughout the world. And we went to war, and the four freedoms probably cover less of the world than they ever did before. I do not believe that the protection of the liberty of other people in itself justifies war, which in the end may perhaps destroy more liberty in the world than it will ever restore. Certainly in Korea, the effort to restore liberty, protect the liberty of the South Koreans, has only resulted so far in the destruction of South Korea.
The MacArthur hearings continued, with General Bradley on the witness stand. The crowded hearings of 2 weeks ago were gone. Although the testimony had passed the million-word mark, fewer and fewer senators were appearing and even less entering the debate.